Good evening and welcome to the February presentation in our fifth series of Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright in the blue, with assistance from our photographer and website master, Haiwang Wong. David Runner is our library technology coordinator. Our speaker tonight is widely acclaimed as Kentucky's most famous landscape photographer. In 2003, he was selected by the Downtown Lexington Corporation as one of their Kentucky stars, along with writers Wendell Berry and Barbara Kingsolver, historian Thomas Clark, musicians J.D. Crow, Bill Monroe, and actor-singer Bill Nave. So you see he keeps the steam company. Like many others, photography was not his first career. He once worked in the Fayette County Judge's Office, owned a restaurant, sold real estate, and served as a child advocate in the Kentucky Council on Child Abuse. He received his BA in communications from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, spent almost 4 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Philippines, and upon his return found employment with United Press International Office in Louisville, Kentucky, later becoming the UPI Bureau Chief for the Lexington, Kentucky office. He sold his first print in 1977 at a Berea art show. Since then, his photographs have appeared in such national publications as Architectural Digest, National Geographic, and Time Life books. His first book of photographs, called simply Kentucky, was published in 1982. Kentucky 2 followed in 1989. Gift of Pleasant Hill, Shaker Community in Kentucky, followed in 1997. And Kentucky 3 in 1999. He also began annually publishing two wall calendars of Kentucky and Pawleys Island, a historic barrier island off the coast of South Carolina, along with a series of note cards, postcards, and posters. His prints have been exhibited widely throughout the country, and he's been the subject of a feature program on KET. In September 2006, the University Press of Kentucky published his newest and what some critics have called his most beautiful collection of photographs, entitled simply James Archambault's Historic Kentucky. It's my pleasure to welcome Kentucky's very own Robert Kincaid, who's even photographed a covered bridge or two, James Archambault.
Thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for that kind welcome. I'm happy to be here in Bowling Green, and I'm honored to have been invited to speak to you tonight as part of the Kentucky Live series sponsored by Western Kentucky University. Special thanks to you, Brian, for having me here tonight and making me feel very welcome. I want to clarify one thing that you said in your introduction. Yes, I did come to Louisville. I was bureau manager, worked at United Press International in Louisville, and then I was made bureau manager in Lexington after that. But I must say that the bureau manager's job was to boss myself because it was a one-man bureau, so I didn't have like this 18 people under me. If you came here tonight, can you hear me okay? Is that okay? If you came here tonight expecting to view a long PowerPoint presentation of my photographs, you may be disappointed. But I hope that many of you here have over the years seen my work through my books and calendars. And just to show you, this is my first book, 1982. And this is my third Kentucky book, published in 1999. And then, as Brian mentioned, I do a series of calendars. This is my Kentucky 2007 calendar. And then my latest book, which came out in October of last year, Historic Kentucky, published by the University Press of Kentucky. The book, Historic Kentucky, focuses on Kentucky history and the numerous historical sites that I have photographed over the past 30 years. The book emphasizes what we as a society, as a state, as a culture have preserved, and necessarily what we have lost and what we are losing. My work as a nature and landscape photographer has taken me across this state many times. According to my mileage records, I can safely say I have driven roughly 1,000,000 miles in Kentucky. That translates into 40 times around the world. Except for perhaps a career state highway inspector, I have seen more of Kentucky than any person has or probably ever will. The subject of my talk here tonight is beauty, something that I have tried to bring to the world through my work. But I want to begin by briefly relating to you the story of how I came to Kentucky 38 years ago, and how that decision would change my life in a direction I could not have anticipated at the time. Kentucky had been spinning around in my mind since age 10, when I watched the first broadcast of the Kentucky Derby on television. The plane of Stephen Foster's My Old Kentucky Home, as the horses came onto the track, touched something inside me in a profound way. It was as if I had been here before, perhaps in a former life, if one believes in such things. And no matter how many times I hear it, My Old Kentucky Home, Good Night, still thrills me even now. Since that day in the early 1950s, I have really missed watching the Kentucky Derby. And since coming to Kentucky in 1969, I have had the privilege of attending 9 Kentucky Derbies as a working photographer. Among many memories I have had the pleasure of witnessing is Genuine Risk in 1980 and Winning Colors in 1988, become only the second and third fillies to win the Kentucky Derby. My interest in Kentucky was further enhanced by a trip I took through the state in 1963. It was in February of that year, as young college students, that a friend of mine and I abandoned winter and drove from our home in western Pennsylvania to central Florida to fish for largemouth bass on the St. Johns River. At that time, interstate highways were only a dream. On the way home, we decided to take the less traveled roads through Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, and West Virginia. It took us 36 hours to return to Pennsylvania. This is when I learned the true meaning of the word back roads. Ironically, at least in my photographic work, I have been traveling the back roads ever since. Part of that nonstop trip was over old U.S. Highway 119 and U.S. Highway 23 through the eastern corner of Kentucky. We went through Harlan, Whitesburg, Partridge, Pikeville, Payne Gap, Zebulon, and others. The number of seemingly endless curves were at times infuriating, and being stuck behind a loaded, creeping, smoking coal truck on a long hill was no fun either. In retrospect, it was an incredible and exciting journey, and forever endeared me to the stark beauty of Kentucky. It was a cloudy, cold, snowless, and misty winter day, but I couldn't help but be struck with the landscape of even this tiny eastern part of Kentucky. I was not a serious photographer then, but I well remember the valley of the Cumberland River, its bare, brown, forested hills, fog rising from the emerald green water. I still carry a picture of that day in my mind, and I will never forget its effect on me. I could not have known then that 7 years later, I would move to Kentucky and to a large extent make this state my life's work. My personal quest for beauty is, and always has been, an attempt to satisfy myself, to give my own heart pleasure as the result of my labors. Whether it was wooing my wife, or searching the roads and woods and rivers for that special photograph that knocks me over with one visual punch. One thing is for sure in my photography, it is my idea of beauty and no one else's. The viewer of my work may love it, dislike it, or be ambivalent. Fortunately, there are enough people who react favorably to my work with the same emotion that I felt when I found the photograph in the first place. One of my ultimate aims is to bring to others what I have seen for myself, for both of our pleasures. There is the added advantage that giving pleasure to others through beauty enables me to make a living, one of those aspects of life that cannot be ignored if one wishes to survive. To the fortunate among us, and I can assume that means most or all of us in this room, survival means more than just the passing of food through our bodies. While that may seem a crude way to put it, the majority of the world's 6 billion people live exactly in this way. Hand to mouth, to sleep, to wake, to acquire food, to eat, to sleep, to wake, to find food, and on and on. To me, the recognition of beauty is nearly as important to our survival as food. Without the recognition of beauty within us and around us, we live in a shadow world of emotional poverty, with the majority of the world's population earning a barely sustainable income, which allows them to continue their existence, but gives them little time or even the thought of looking for beauty. In fact, my own search for beauty nearly came to a crashing halt 35 years ago over the more pressing need for food and shelter. When I informed my friends and family that I was going to quit my day job and become a landscape photographer, the reaction ranged from being completely aghast to barely heard snickers to sympathetic hands on my shoulders and those whispered and mystified words, "What on earth are you doing?" My answer in my own mind was, "Why on earth am I here?" For 3 years, I survived on peanut butter and cheap beer. I had help from friends, one of whom let me live in an old framed house he owned in Lexington. He offered me the house rent-free if I would pay the utilities, occasionally attend to the leaking roof, and try to keep the possums out of the kitchen. It was a deal I couldn't refuse, even though I don't particularly care for possums. Another friend allowed me, whenever I needed money, to drive nails for him in a small housing project he was developing in the hills south of Pikeville in eastern Kentucky. For this, I bunked rent-free in an old trailer next to the site and earned $7 an hour, which bought me film and kept the utilities running and the possums happy in the house in Lexington. This was my first and last experience in the field of carpentry, although I did learn to drive a mean nail without smashing my thumb too many times. In other words, my quest for beauty came with a price. I was already in my 30s, and my 30-something peers had fast cars, jobs that paid real money, attractive husbands and wives, smart kids, little league, soccer games, extravagant dinner parties, long vacations, and big homes with possum-free kitchens. Many times I doubted the turn in the road that I had taken. My quest for beauty was no match for a pile of nasty, mostly unpayable bills. A particular low point occurred in the spring of 1981 I've been photographing great blue herons in far west Kentucky when I realized I was low on gas and had no cash. My only option was to beg. I stopped at the only bank in a little town called Hawesville on the Ohio River near Owensboro. Having reached the end of the road, I marched confidently into the bank in full beard, shaggy hair, and otherwise ragged attire, and asked to see the president. He was kind and gracious, and fortunately believed my story about searching for beauty and being broke. Without knowing me at all, he cashed my shaky check for $15, and I made it home. Through persistence, the help of friends, and some timely luck, I was able to come out the other side of my three-year odyssey. Since 1982, I have produced 5 photographic books, more than 30 wall calendars, thousands of note cards, postcards, prints, and made a fairly good living from my craft. The dictionary defines beauty as the quality which makes an object seem pleasing or satisfying in a certain way. Those qualities which give pleasure to the aesthetic sense, as by line, color, form, texture, proportion, rhythmic motion, tone, etc., or by behavior or attitude. What this definition suggests is that beauty is manifested in many forms. Although my own work is nature-oriented and two-dimensional, I was particularly struck by the last line in the dictionary definition I just quoted. Beauty as shown in a person's behavior or attitude. Here is a poem I wrote several years ago. It's called Girlfriends. They were together at the party, one physically attractive, the other somewhat plain. But when the plain girl opened her mouth and the strength of her thoughts flowed into my mind and heart, she became the object of my attention, her plainness transforming into beauty. In other words, beauty is everywhere, in many different forms, if we just take the time and know where to look and recognize it when we see it. Now I come to the real blockbuster of my presentation. I've searched the local library and read 42 books on the subject of beauty. I really haven't. And spent years searching for beauty, which I have. And after all this effort and soul searching, I have concluded that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Like seeing the tattooed woman at the sideshow, I'm sure many of you are shocked by this amazing revelation. But the truth is that beauty is subjective. We choose companions, friends, lovers, paintings, murals, dinnerware, watercolors, cars, floor tile, t-shirts, lipstick, pets, homes, vacation retreats because we like them. Because we feel they are beautiful, or they make us feel beautiful. Of course, sometimes in real life, we may acquiesce at times to the beauty demands of our significant others. Where does this subjectivity for beauty originate? Is it in our brains? To me, our individual recognition of beauty comes from the heart. Cupid's arrow does not aim for the brain. It aims for the heart. Once the arrow finds its target, beauty cannot be stopped or ignored. Why I search for beauty through photography is easy, because I enjoy it. I love driving the roads all day, taking photographs of what may come before me. The most exciting part of my quest is in the finding of the thing, like a fisherman goes fishing or a hunter goes hunting. Something unanticipated, surprising, and yes, emotional is what I'm looking for. Emotion comes from the heart. If I don't feel emotion while contemplating a subject, I move on rather than fight it. I have witnessed photographers who fight for subject matter when there is really, in my opinion, nothing worth fighting for. I say, let the beauty come to me or you. If you are open to it, you will recognize it and you will feel it. When I first began taking photography seriously, I remember the day I crossed that emotional threshold. On a 10-degree day in Greenup County, Kentucky, I drove around a bend in the road and came upon an old white church covered in snow, the bleak winter mountains in the background. There was no question in my mind. I was compelled to take the photograph. I pulled off on the shoulder and in the raw wind set up my tripod and camera in the middle of the road. My hands were freezing and I had to repeatedly plunge them into my pockets for a second or two of warmth. And then in the midst of the exposure, I noticed that I was perspiring. Perspiring from the excitement in finding the photograph. In the early years of my work, it happened many times, raw cheeks, freezing hands, and perspiration pouring down my brow. I believe that there are those of us who see beauty more easily than others. Recognizing beauty is a combination of an innate gift, intuition if you will, and a lot of hard work. Another of my poems illustrates this point. The creation of any meaningful work of art or idea cannot rely solely on unrequested inspiration. Most often it has to be painfully dug out in great shovels full of time. I had a friend named Frank who in my early days of photographing would frequently go with me on my quest for beauty on weekends. We would lumber up and down the back roads of Kentucky in my old Chevy pickup truck. Except for a vague direction in a general highway map, I had no idea where I was going or what I was looking for. Actually, I still use that method today. It's called the hunt and peck method. Frank would say to me, "Why did you turn on this road?" "I don't know, Frank," I would say. "It just feels right." He would shake his head and ramble on about how his Philadelphia Eagles had a chance to make the playoffs that year. Most often when that feel right thing began pounding in my chest, I would pull off on the shoulder, turn off the engine, and stare at the presented landscape. "Why did we stop here?" Frank would ask. "I don't actually know," I would say. "There is something about the light and the shape of that hill and how that old barn squeezes itself tight around the rutted road in the valley. It's just a feeling," I would conclude. Frank would look at the same thing I was looking at. "Oh yeah, I think I see it," he would say, shrugging his shoulders and then prancing off into how the Philadelphia 76ers basketball team was going to kick butt this year with their two new rookies, Benson Leroy and Joe what's-his-name. Barely conscious of Frank's presence, I would weigh the scene in my heart and either drag out my cameras and tripod and take the shot or shake my head and drive on down the road looking for more feel rights. Eventually, whenever I would pull off the road, Frank would invariably say, "Oh, another beauty spot." That's what he would call those stops, beauty spots. Even though he usually didn't have a clue as to why I had stopped. Don't get me wrong, I love Frank. He's a smart guy. We had some great talks on politics, history, and solved several of the world's problems in between beauty spots. Some of our best times were when we'd stop to eat our lunch of sandwiches and peanuts and play gin rummy on the tailgate of my pickup. But when it came to beauty, Frank drew a blank. For example, he would wear black and red plaid pants with an orange t-shirt, a shout of distraction from the passenger seat that was hard to ignore. Although we remained close friends, Frank stopped coming with me, bored, I'm sure, with watching this crazy man looking for beauty, when he knew in his heart that beauty was sitting on his warm couch in front of the TV, drinking a cold Michelob and watching the Eagles and the Jets pound each other into the sod on a Sunday afternoon. When my first book, Kentucky, was published, Frank was amazed. "You took all these pictures?" he asked. "Yes," I said, and you were with me on a number of occasions. And I would point out the specific photographs to him. "Oh yeah, I remember that," Frank would say weakly. Eventually, Frank got his master's degree in social work from UK, sold his house to me, and moved his wife and son to North Carolina, and climbed into the higher echelons of the federal government, happy as a clam. To me, the most enduring gift of finding and looking upon beauty is that it is free. Yes, photographers must buy their film, and in my case, do extensive traveling. Painters must acquire paints and brushes and easels and ideas. Potters must buy clay and wheels and kilns, and musicians their instruments. The poet is probably closest to being on the cheap, only pen and paper required. But no matter what is produced, the painting, the photograph, the vase, the poem, it all has its source in the mind and heart of the maker. It is the love of the craft, the love of creating beauty by the makers for their own enjoyment and for the rest of us to appreciate. Beauty is not found inside the camera, although a lot of people think that it really is. It's in that camera somewhere. It is not contained in tubes of paint and brushes. The keys of the piano or the strings of the harp, while well-crafted, are individually dumb without the heart of the player for the love of what they do to bring their instruments to life, to beauty. Beauty does have its detractors. Perhaps it is the very overuse of the word beauty that has become passé in some circles. "Oh, that is beautiful. She is beautiful. Your wallpaper is beautiful. Your house, car, dress, suit is beautiful," and so on. We hear the word so often that it becomes meaningless. I also fear that our obsession with technology is taking over our attentions to the detriment of our abilities to view the world, the beauty of the world around us, cutting us off from nature into a new and perhaps dangerous world of televisions, computers, cell phones, and iPods. To me, these instruments create an artificial world, which then becomes the real world, most particularly to the young. One of the things I did not anticipate when I began photographing was how my work would influence other people, help open their eyes, or sensitize them to the daily plate of possibilities spread before them. When you walk or drive around tomorrow and in the weeks ahead, look for beauty. It is everywhere. From your child's smile to the wet autumn leaves on the sidewalk, the morning sun pouring red light into your kitchen, the moon shining down as you walk the path to this building tonight, or in the coming spring, the woman next door bent over clusters of red tulips, carefully, lovingly cutting them one by one, oblivious of your observation, destined for the vase on her dining room table, the food will taste so much better. After my friend Frank's retirement from accompanying me on photographic journeys, a void was created that was soon filled by my future wife. Now here is a woman who understands beauty and often points out photographic possibilities. She was and is a prodigious reader, which has gotten her through the inevitable boring times watching me looking for photographs. Well, I somehow have twisted my words around here, my pages, but I want to end by saying that I hope that you can all find your own beauty, and I'm sure that most of you have, and that if you have and do, it will give you great pleasure in your life. I want to leave you with another poem that tells as best I can what constitutes, in my view, a great photograph. A great photograph captures the essence of a thing. It captures the unseen underside of a place, an event, a person, when the true seam of the subject is bared for all to see. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And we have time for questions for James.
Yes.
Do you mind to talk to us a little bit about what you said as you began? Maybe it was in the introduction. What we've lost and what we're losing?
Well, in 30 years of photographing around Kentucky, I've photographed a lot of the historical sites that we all know that have been preserved. Jefferson Davis Monument, to name a few, the Shaker Village here at Logan County, and well, there's various other. But there's also a lot of places that have been lost. When I first started photographing in 1969 in Kentucky, there were maybe, I don't know, 40 or 50 covered bridges. Now there are 13, that kind of thing. And country stores that up until about the mid-70s, many of which were still there and still operating, actually, are now closed. Most are closed, and the ones that have been closed are falling down. And maybe it's just inevitable, but there's a lot of people in Kentucky, though, who have and are preserving the history of this great state. And as I point out in my book, one of the things that I think Kentucky has been, in some ways, a forgotten state. I know when I travel outside of Kentucky and people say, "Where are you from?" I say, "Kentucky, Kentucky," you know, and they kind of think it's somehow down there, squeezed between Alabama and Mississippi. And when I say, "Well, I live only like an hour south of Cincinnati, Ohio," they go, "You know, how can that be?" But Kentucky has been, because of its geographical location, the rivers on two sides and then the mountains on the other side, it has been a forgotten state, but I think in many ways that's a good thing because it still has that feeling, that tradition, the cultural kinds of oldness, if I might use that term, that has preserved what we have around us, and I'm afraid that we're losing a lot of it. One thing that disturbs me a lot is what I call rural sprawl, which, I mean, you can just drive down in the middle of nowhere and all of a sudden there's a subdivision of some kind, and you go, what is that attached to? You know, I mean, those kind of things disturb me, but I guess they would a landscape photographer who's always looking for the pristine kind of thing. Yes?
How did you first publicize your photographs and get the book deal to do your very first one?
Boy, that I mentioned in my speech, it was a combination of being in the right place at the right time and some luck. But I was photographing. I had some photographs in a little, like a little shop in downtown Lexington, like a print shop, a little box of 8x10 prints. And the publisher of this first book came to Lexington to interview photographers to do the book on Kentucky, the first book that I showed you. And he walked in that store and looked at those photographs. I mean, I didn't even know that he was coming to Kentucky, to Lexington. I didn't know there was anything about this. And he inquired, got my name, called me on the phone, asked me if I wanted to be interviewed. Gotta be kidding, you know. So anyway, I went down and I was hired. So talk about a wonderful occurrence in one's life. That was probably the thing that changed my life the most, was that phone call. Yes.
We're from Western Kentucky. We've lived in Eastern Kentucky and now here. Don't you think we have more photo ops in our state than most?
Oh, absolutely. I think Kentucky's just a, well, as you can tell, I mean, I've spent my whole half my life anyway photographing it, and I never get tired of it. When you travel to other states, and of course there are the Rocky Mountains and the Sierras, and there's the desert, and there's the coast of Maine, but when you get right down to it, there's nothing really more beautiful than Kentucky, and its diversity, and its climate, and its variety of wildflowers and trees, and it sits right in the middle of the country, so it has the best of the north and the best of the south and the mountains and the hills and of course all the rivers and streams. I mean, it's a wonderful place. It's sort of undiscovered in a way, although I think it's becoming more discovered. But yes.
What would be your favorite county in Kentucky, or the
oh boy,
the most beauty spots?
Well, whenever you name a county or counties or names of people, you always leave out more than you included. But I would say that, I mean, it put me on the spot. I would say the center of the state, from the northern Kentucky area, just a swath right down to the Tennessee border, and on in between I-65 and I-75, that whole area in there, and I think not only does it have a diversity of landscape and a lot of rivers and streams and stuff, but that was where Kentucky was first settled. And so there's a lot of history there in addition to the landscape. That's where the pioneers came. That's where they first settled. The first 25 years of Kentucky's existence was in the central part of the state, the bluegrass. And of course, I lived there. It's also easier to get around. But the entire state has its own particular beauty. Yes.
Project
about seven. Well, I have been wanting to do a book on the bluegrass, just on the bluegrass area, which would be what we would all probably think of as the horse farm area of Kentucky. A book maybe on Naturally Kentucky, just on nature. Some of the, which I have, I mean, I've sort of been working on these. I've got all this stuff in my studio sort of all segregated out, and, you know, when I feel like I have enough material, maybe I'll do a book, you know. Okay, I'm ready to do a book now. I'm working on a book, on Pawleys Island, which is a barrier island off the coast of South Carolina, which I spend a lot of time at, and I think I've almost got a book ready for that. So I'm always thinking about projects. It's just a matter of time. And when I say that, I mean time and time left. So there's, you know, if I could publish five ideas that I had tomorrow, I would. But well, I shot film for 30 years, and then a year and a half ago I went to digital, and then about 6 months ago I went back to film. So, but I have to say, I use most of my work is a 2.25 format, medium format, which does provide a very nice original. And but if you take digital, a good digital camera, and compare it to 35 millimeter film, even the best film, I think the digital wins out in my experiments that I've done. But digital still doesn't compare, in my opinion, with 2.25 film. Yes.
Do
any formal training in photography or required certified?
No, I just started doing it on my own. Something I just picked up. Well, when I was a kid and growing up, I was I hiked and camped and fished and hunted, and so I was used to spending a lot of time outdoors. So when I finally picked the camera up, all of that experience in nature kind of came together, and you know, it worked out. I didn't take any classes. I did spend a lot of time in libraries and bookstores looking at other people's photography. That's a big way to learn about photography, is looking at other people's photographs. You can learn a whole lot. I just picked most of the photographers who I am aware of. They were doing something else and just became photographers over just out of love. I mean, Elliot Porter, who you may know and remember, he was a pioneer in color photography and probably the person that I have admired the most over the years. He was a doctor. He was an MD. The guy Ansel Adams was a musician. So there's a lot of other examples.
One more question?
Yes.
What is your opinion about the best way to work with children to help them see beauty? I'm thinking is that they are so latchkeyed and computered. And,
yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Most of us who are older played outside more.
Oh, we did. Oh. Yeah.
What do you think is the best way for those of us tree huggers?
I mean, a wooden boat in the bathtub was like fantastic. I mean, really, a wooden boat in the bathtub. I think there's got to be some pushing the issue to some extent. I think you've got to get them outside or get them in museums or wherever you think you can, aquariums, wherever you think you can find beauty, but you can get them off of those headphones and TV and so forth. I think that there's a place for all of that, for sure, but I think it's just overdone right now. And maybe I'm just a dinosaur. You know, I call myself a dinosaur, but I kind of like being a dinosaur. I often say to people that I'm glad that I have lived when I did. I really am, because the future. Yes. And I don't, although I certainly hope for the best in the future, not only for this country, but for the world, I sometimes wonder where it's going to.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.